Today is October 23rd, and we're having Dan Steinbach with us to talk about his new book. It's called The Fall of Israel. And he's talking about what's going on with Israel and the conflict in the Middle East. The link of this book is in the description of this video. You can access it and you can buy it. Let's get started with the question. The first question then would be, how do you find right now the situation of Israel when you compare it to Israel before October 7th and right now?
Paradoxical. I find it that it's lots more complicated, lots more difficult than perhaps at any time of its history. When Israel has had wars that it has considered to be victorious, triumphant, like the Six-Day War, that was 6 days. This has been going for a year. And in the beginning, the idea, if I understood it right, and I think most people thought, that the stated objective was to, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said, eliminate Hamas and release the hostages. Neither has happened. We have seen instead a massive number of civilian victims, something we've never seen before, never. And to my astonishment, when I looked at all of these crises that have happened in the Middle East, where Israel has played a part, from its Independence Day War and from the Palestinian perspective, the Nakba, to the present, and you add all the casualties, wounded and killed, the number of people that have been wounded and killed in this war is far higher. This one war for 1 year. If this continues the way it has prevailed, it will undermine Israel's economic futures. It has already undermined the very existence of too many Palestinians. And as much as I try to relate to the objectives that Israel has, sometimes they have been valid. In this case, I don't think that they are. At all, and may not have been so for a very long time. We know for sure that 70% of the victims tend to be women and children. What kind of assets are they in this war? How will their demise enable Israel to have more security? I simply don't see this. So I find that this is paradoxical because it leaves Israel in a very vulnerable position. Yet within Israel, I think that there's this feeling of, particularly the past few weeks, as some of the leaders of Hamas have been killed, almost a sense of triumph, a sense of victory or a coming victory. And I'm afraid that this kind of situation emerges almost like a parallel reality when most of the world, the international community, sees things in a certain way. Within Israel, things are seen in another way. And I think that one of the key reasons to this is, and I try to argue that in the book, is the role of the United States as a big or great enabler, if you will. So the long and short, to recap, I think what we've seen for a year now is a war in Gaza. I'm not sure it's a war against Hamas. I think it's a war in Gaza. We've seen it now extend from Gaza to southern Lebanon and even to Iran. And to Yemen, and to West Bank in a certain ways, in a certain sense. And this momentum shifting to other areas, I think it's a very ominous sign. It reflects something that may yet to come. And I'm not very optimistic about that direction. I think it's a deliberate conflict escalation on the part of the Netanyahu cabinet. And there the question then becomes, why can this happen? And I think that there are two major reasons for it. One, that the Biden administration doesn't seem to be willing, is able, but not willing to subdue this kind of devastation. And then the somewhat surprising impotence of the international community to intervene and to contain these atrocities. And that leads to a situation where the potential for regional escalation is steadily rising. So it's no longer a question, will it happen, but where, when, and how? And this can be militarily very successful as a tactic, but no tactic creates peace. That comes with strategy. And tactic is based basically on abuse with principles of humanity, if you will, in this particular case, whereas strategy would have to be based on trust and dialogue. Dialogue works. And if this is missing, I don't see the end to this. Of course, there will be an end to it, but it will be something very dark.
Do you think that the main goal of the Netanyahu administration was the security of Israel, or they're looking for a bigger conflict in the Middle East? That's, and they can easily destroy Gaza, destroy West Bank, and just send their people to these regions, just capturing them. Because the way that they're talking about Lebanon and Iran right now, they want a bigger conflict. At the same time, we know what has happened in Gaza. We know how they were not capable of destroying Hamas. They were killing civilians. But right now, with this expansion of the conflict with Hezbollah and Iran, what are they looking for, in your opinion? Is that all about Gaza and West Bank?
I think that your question presumes that there is more to it, and I tend to agree. Many people, particularly military observers, have been concerned about the idea of multi-front war. Could Israel handle it? And I see a situation where obviously it started from Gaza, and it has been expanding, and we could talk about the milestones, some of which I outlined in the book. But I think that what is also happening is something very intriguing. If you would have parallel conflicts, and to the degree we have things going on in Israel proper, we have things going on in Gaza, Gaza Strip, West Bank, southern Lebanon, up to Litani River at least, and beyond, even to Beirut. We see things happening in Jordan, Syria, Yemen, and so on and so forth. And we wonder what will happen in the case of Iran. There seems to be some sort of a tacit blueprint to this. But the way it happens is in a sequence. It started from Gaza, and then it's spreading. When the momentum is moving away from Gaza, not all the activities, but the momentum. We see this from the fact that the northern Gaza is now under heavy bombardment. And I don't think that these are military assets alone. I think that from the beginning of the war, there has been an effort to create an area of cushion, if you will. And that goes to cut the area of Gaza even smaller and smaller. It's cut by 1,000 cuts. Now, if you can handle this and then move to the next theater of war, as the military observers call it, in a sequence, it's easier than waging these wars in parallel. But it hasn't happened in sequence, and it hasn't happened exactly in parallel. It's been a dirty war in that sense as well. Netanyahu cabinet, of course, has said from the beginning that Israel has a right to defend itself. It has a responsibility to defend itself. That's absolutely true. Both the right and the responsibility. But that doesn't seem to be the question, really, because then the question becomes, what about the Palestinians? Do they have a right and responsibility to defend themselves? And I think that they do. What about the Lebanese? What about the Yemen? What about Iranians and so on and so forth? This is a very strange situation where it's hard for me to see that any other country could do achieve the same objectives that Israel has so far done, without international sanctions, without international intervention. And that takes us back to the role of the great powers, the role of the United States and a few other countries. There seems to be a tacit subtext to this. If you defend yourself against Israel, we see that the hostile action and we will punish you. And that doesn't seem to be something that a credible broker would do in this kind of a situation. So I don't see this as an asset to U.S. objectives in the Middle East. It may be that in the short term, from purely military point of view, but that point of view has never created peace. And that's why I think we are where we are, at least I argue in the book, that what we see right now is the result of 50 years of failed military diplomacy in the region, mainly by the US because it has such a major influence in the area. But the problems themselves go back to the ethnic expulsions from late 1940s to the present.
Who's responsible for this failure? Is the neocons in the United States? Is the Israeli lobby in the United States? The Israeli government, who has a lot of leverage on Washington? How do you find the balance of power when it comes to the Middle East?
That was the question I posed to myself when I started writing the book. And I tried all kinds of pathways to reach an explanation via an Occam's razor, if you will, explanation that would be concise and simple and yet comprehensive enough to give me a general idea of what's going on here and why is it so difficult to move ahead? And why is it that things seem to be getting worse, even though we're talking about the countries that have got the bulk, most of the US economic and military aid in the past 50 years? And prior to that, the role of Britain, the role of France, and other great powers in the region. So in the fall of Israel, I went back to the idea of there being four major structural forces that account for a series of cumulative disasters in the Middle East. I call them the Great Conjuncture, because I don't think that it's a perfect storm. Perfect storms are possible in mathematics. We humans are imperfect, so we create imperfect storms, and this might be one of those. But it is a confluence of different kind of forces. And I think that the key trigger in all of this has been the waves of Palestinian expulsions since the late 1947s. This precedes the state of Israel and creation in 1948. Whichever way one looks at this crisis, one always comes back to this. Even I personally wasn't aware of the full weight of this factor until the 1980s. When the so-called Israeli new historians were able to access the declassified files in Israel and take another look at the past history. Prior to that, though, Palestinian historians had made it very clear that these expulsions happened, but they had been ignored to a large extent. Why? Because they didn't have the kind of voice that the historians of a sovereign nation would have. And they were considered to be partial, not academic enough, not knowledgeable enough. But they had a point because they had access to people who suffered the bulk of these expulsions, the Palestinians. On the Israeli side, historians like Benny Morris was able to show how critically the events of 1948 have to do with what goes on in the present. The Sun, ex-member of Shin Bet, I think, Israeli security and accomplished soldier himself, the son of Moshe Shavret, the first foreign minister of Israel, used to call it the original crime, these expulsions. And I think that one really has to go back to that far to understand what is going on here. The second aspect of this all, and if I may add, with the expulsions, I think really it was the work of Ilan Pappe, around 20 years ago, his work made it very clear that it was not just the net effect of war, as Benny Morris would have it. He pointed out that in war, bad things happen. Ilan Pappe was able to show that there were objectives, there were intentions, there were collectives actively creating these goals early on, 1930s and 40s. And I talk about those a lot in the book. Let's keep in mind also what happens right now. One reason why the hammering of North Gaza is escalating may be that there is an increasing feeling within Israel that this area could be ground zero for new kind of Jewish settlements. Those that left 2005 can now come back. Certainly among the settlers, this is a great hope. I consider it something very different. Now, second aspect of the Great Conjuncture, if you will, would be the expressive expansion of these Jewish settlements. in the Palestinian occupied territories. This started already in the late 60s under the Labour government, if I may add. And that, I think, was one of the greatest mistakes that the Labour government did in its first decade after the Six-Day War. My dear friend, whose books I once translated, Amos Oz, the great novelist, called them the neo-Nazis already in 1967. There were others who saw quite clearly where this would take people. Yael Dayan, the daughter of General Moshe Dayan, whom I met around 1973, and who was then already active in peace movement and later became one of the peace activists, just as Amos Oz became the co-founder of Peace Now, a movement that I've supported ever since then. They saw what was coming, and other Israelis as well, but they couldn't stop it when the government allowed it to happen. There was a so-called Yigal Alon plan that aimed still at national security, and the hope was that there would be some kind of a settlement, two-state solution, if you will. But somehow that was ignored, because on the one hand, there was this talk about Alon plan, but it was never taken forward by the Israelis, and it had a lot of aspects that would have not been agreeable to many Arab countries and certainly to Palestinians. But at least there was an effort to that direction. Things changed dramatically with the election of 1977 when the Likud government, what I called hard right or harsh right, came into power. Now, this is not your normal right-wing movement. Of course, there were elements of free trade, free markets, and so on and so forth. And they had, in some areas, certain points. The Labour government had allowed too many monopolies, not enough competition, not enough market-led initiatives. But these constraints were turned upside down. When this government came in, this cabinet came in by Menachem Begin, what we saw was, on the one hand, the rise of neoconservative economic policies, but on the other hand, a very aggressive state-led effort to support these Jewish settlements, so much so that in the early 1980s, some people, like the deputy mayor of Jerusalem at the time, Ben Venista, said that, have we reached the point of irreversibility? Are there so many settlers in the West Bank that we can no longer reverse the course of history? We have to live with this. The reality is that those settlements could be removed. They were removed in 2005. They could be removed now. That's a political issue, not a military issue. They are a hindrance to peace. Israeli organizations, think tanks like Mollad, have shown how so much of the government budget goes to subsidizing the settlements and the settlers, and so little actually to Israeli protection. It has turned upside down this relationship, which is very dangerous to Israel. What has made this, I think, still more problematic is the rise of Israeli far right in the last elections, 2022 in the fall. Now, when I protested the settler movements, those were Gush Emunim, Maale Adumim site, in 1974 and 1975 when they were created. But at the time, there were 3,000 to 4,000 settlers, I believe. Now, settlers claim that including Jerusalem, there might be more than 800,000. And that's not far from the truth. So there is this messianic far right now in the government. In the book, I argue that there, it's a bit of a situation like you let the foxes into the hen house. And you look what happens next. Well, we know what happens next. The people that were considered to be criminals, if not criminals, quasi-criminals, still decade, two or three ago, are now making decisions, administrative decisions, about the fate of the settlements. This has led to anti-Arab pogroms, which I find are not that different from those waged conducted against the Jews more than a century ago. And I'm not alone in this. There are Israeli generals who agree on it, and I have been on the record on that. There are Israeli leaders, ex-leaders of Mossad, Tamir Pardor, in the forefront, who have argued that Israel is constrained by apartheid rule in the occupied territories. So the question is, what are you going to do about it? I feel that the second factor, the aggressive expansion of Jewish settlements, has led to a situation where these areas are now being effectively annexed into Israel. Amid the fog of war, this started really taking a very different direction, faster direction in early summer through administrative measures, particularly by Minister Ostrich. The third element in this great conjuncture is half a century of failed American diplomacy in the Middle East. And what I try to show in the book is how the ties between the US and Israel have moved through four stages, through hedging choosing sides, partnership, and the symbiotic ties. Now, it's often being said that, well, Truman is the first to recognize Israel, but not true. It was Stalin. Truman did it de facto, but never de jure. It took a year to get to that point. Stalin did both immediately, almost overnight. And the reason is that Israel was closer to those egalitarian ideas in the very beginning. It also got its arm from Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia mainly, thereafter from France. Only later, the US comes into play in the mid to late 60s. So there was a lot of hedging. And one reason was that Americans were very uneasy with the idea of the kind of a two-state solution that would create constant bloodshed. CIA did a major study around 1947-48 where they said that the creation of Israel, or unilateral declaration of Israel, might lead to a situation of long-range disaster. And Marshall and many other major influential authorities of American foreign policy, they're strongly for the idea that there should be a different kind of solution. Truman gave in. He wanted to have the Jewish vote. The course of the Middle East at the time was such that the constituency on the Arab side was minimal, and also the oil interests were not very strong in the US in that regard, that they could have changed his way of looking at things. And the security state was being created in the US at the time as well. So the relationship moves to choosing sides, then that moves to strategic partnership by Reagan, and or Nixon and Reagan, 70s and 80s. I think part of the reason was actually the fact that Israel was in deep trouble in 1973 during the Yom Kippur War. And what happened behind the facade was nuclear mobilization. And perhaps one consideration that President Nixon had for the flow of arms quickly to Israel was the fear of what Israelis might do if they perceived this to be an existential challenge. Just like today, there's this consideration of Iran, for all the wrong reasons, I believe. So in any case, we are moving to the strategic partnership, and then by 90s and thereafter, particularly with President Bush, into basically symbiotic ties. And these ties have just got deeper and deeper from Bush to Obama and to Trump and Biden. This term ironclad ties that we hear again and again reflects that. In the book, I argue that there are ties that bind, but I don't think these are that kind of ties. These are ties that blind, because it's not good for the US foreign policy, and it's not good for Israeli security. Israel is giving up its sovereignty this way, and there are many Israeli generals who are concerned about this. Who makes the decision of interceptors and what they do and when they do it and how they do it when missiles appear? It may no longer happen in Israel. It may happen in Pentagon. And there are a lot of consequences from this. And what is new also here is that there were a lot of atrocities until now. There was Sabra Shatila during the Lebanese War in 1982. I protested against this. Amos Oz did so. Yael Dayan did so. Primo Levi, the Holocaust survivor whose books I was promoting at the time, did so. He said, and I always felt that this quote was very important. It's so important to me as well. He said that, "I feel great emotional affinity with Israel, but not with this Israel, not with the Israel of Menachem Begin." And this kind of activities that Israel has now engaged in for all kinds of reasons have taken also things to a point where US is complicit to a degree to what Israel has done. And this involves genocidal atrocities. And finally, that takes us to the fourth point of this great conjuncture. And I'm sorry about the monologue, but I feel strongly about these four factors. The fourth one is America's massive military aid to Israel. $18 billion in the past year alone. And I can't help but wonder, what if that money had been invested into building new schools, building new hospitals, taking care of people's welfare, social security, Jews, Israeli Arabs, Palestinians, and so on and so forth, rather than for obliteration, thinking that that creates security. And that has led to a lot of things also within Israel, in the sense that when you have so much military aid coming in, then Israel can afford to do certain things on its own. For instance, its military exports intensified as the aid from the US picked up. It's understandable. If the United States is paying for my arms to that degree, then I can afford to start exporting mine. And then you look where those arms are going. Sometimes the ties are with advanced economies like Germany and others, or Germany exports to Israel. But Israel has also got involved with a lot of dirty wars. In the 80s, it was all involved with apartheid South Africa. These are ties that are very, very hard to understand with the history of Israel. And they should never be there, I feel. So this kind of a military assistance has created parallel militarization within Israel. And that's why I had a subtitle for this book about degrading Israeli economy, politics, and military. And I feel this is the end result. So you have these four factors then: ethnic expulsions of Palestinians, settlements, Jewish settlements, US-Israeli military ties, the way they have evolved into symbiosis, and the military aid. And these are feeding each other. We cannot have an end to any or find any durable solution without dealing with these four aspects together and separately, whichever way we choose to deal with them.
Whenever we talk about sovereignty and we talk about security, I think the economy has a great role in all of these aspects. Do you think, how do you find the Israeli economy right now?
You know, I titled the book The Fall of Israel, and immediately people started to speculate. So what does this mean? Does it mean that it's a biblical term, falling from grace? Maybe partly. There were some who felt that I was arguing that Israel is going economically bankrupt. I'm certainly saying that there's an economic fall involved here. And if people aren't careful, a lot more will follow. The downgrades that we've seen lately reflect what's to come if this continues. And still others stress the destructive impact of the perfect storm in the Middle East. But really what I was thinking about was Gunnar Myrdal, the Swedish economist who got the Nobel Prize in the 70s. His book from 1944, American Dilemma, which was really about the gap between the American creed of opportunity and the ugly realities of segregation. And I felt that, my God, in Israel, we have something very similar. These parallels clearly abound in that we have this gap between Israel and Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs. We have a gap between Israel and the Palestinians, especially when we look at this from GDP per capita living standards point of view. And we certainly have a huge gap between Israeli and the Palestinians. Then we have a gap within the Palestinians between the West Bank and Gaza, a huge gap, part of the reason that we have this terrible situation right now. This is not because of our Palestinians, it's not because of Hamas, it's because of the blockade of Gaza after a democratic election 2006. So there are a lot of factors here. And worst of all, you have these gaps within Israel. You have gaps between the rich and the poor. And these are just getting worse. Of all the OECD economies in Israel, the gap between the rich and the poor is worse. The welfare state that Israelis were so proud of still in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and for a reason, I feel, there was an effort from the start to create a safe basis for people, Jews, coming to Israel. That's falling apart, and there was never a clear idea, actually, whose welfare state it really was. If Israel is to be the secular democratic state, as I think most labor people believed from the very start, it didn't happen effectively, because the Israeli Arabs lived under military rule for 20 years until the end of the 60s. And even today, and even thereafter, after 1967, 1968, you can make a case of segmentation, differentiation, discrimination, even segregation in certain times and certain periods, and so on and so forth. But when you look at the Israeli economy, I think that there was a great choice that was made in the 1950s. And I talk about it in the last chapter of the book. Then for a moment of time, Moshe Sharet, the first foreign minister of Israel, became the PM, the prime minister. Now, he had paid attention to the Bandung Conference of the emerging economies, as we call them today, or the third world at the time, in Indonesia. And he thought that Israel was kind of in between. It wasn't, it came from the West, but it was a colonial state. But it wanted to live in peace with the Arab population. That was his way of looking at it. What it needed was peace, stability, development, regional cooperation. And these initiatives that he was pushing very hard, to the point of negotiating a peace settlement with the Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, in mid-1950s, these were constantly undermined by those who felt that what was needed was Israeli expansion, because the borders that Israel got 1948 were not big enough. Israel wanted to have more, and it wanted to have Gaza, it wanted to have West Bank, and it wanted to have part of Lebanon after the Litani River. Some people in the Herut movement, which was part of the parties behind Likud, wanted to have more of the greater Israel, but there was just no capabilities that Israel had to go so far. In any case, those options were given up, and as a result, Israel had to struggle a lot economically. Had it not been the German aid, economic aid at the time, I'm not entirely sure that Israel had survived as well as it did. It was a German aid in the 1950s, and then American aid starting in the 60s that made a huge difference, along with the support of a world jury, particularly American jury, and which has now taken dark turns as well. So when you look at Israel then today, where does it leave the economy today? It leaves it in a very fragile place. You cannot have this kind of war without it having major implications. You have, first of all, more than 2 million people displaced in Gaza. You have tens of thousands of people displaced in Lebanon, who had absolutely nothing to do with Gaza, this crisis. You can argue about the Hezbollah, absolutely. But does it mean that the civilians, women and children, should die in Lebanon? Absolutely not. Why on earth isn't there international intervention to stop this madness, this bloodshed? So you have these blueprints to towards a different kind of a future, but they are not happening. And I'm very concerned where it leaves Israel should the situation last another half year or so. But let's make no mistakes. I think that Netanyahu cabinet has been playing time ever since October the 7th. And you can argue whether this war was a surprise or not. I don't think it was. Because ever since October the 7th, they've been playing time. And they've been trying to play time with the US election. And the idea was first to lean on the Democrats as long as they allow this cabinet to do whatever they wanted to do, achieve their objectives. When the Biden administration started to feel very uneasy about this, they started to court the Republican Congress. This has been the Netanyahu habit for the past 25 years or more, and it continues right now. So they know that they have a window of opportunity, and that will start closing after the first week of November. There's still those 2 months before the transition where things are sort of in vacuum. And I think that they are trying to use it. So they know that this cannot continue from the point of view of the economy. But the Israeli debt per GDP is still relatively low. So you can play this game if you want to. But my God, look at the price. The price being that the Hamas will not end. There will be just a new kind of Hamas, maybe with a different name or the same name, we don't know. The hostages, they have been ignored almost from the very beginning, the Israeli hostages, and not all of them are Jews. The Palestinians, is there any proportion in terms of the Hamas offensive and Israeli defense, which I call net offense, actually? Absolutely not. It's almost like a defense gone amok at this point of time. So the results are absolutely devastating for the Israeli economy as well. And I think that they show also that Israel is far more vulnerable than people have thought. The fact that even now these bombs keep coming, as hard as Hamas has been hit, as hard as Hezbollah has been hit. And we know that there's a lot more still in the storage, both in the case of Hamas, especially with Hezbollah, and far more with Iran. So the question is not whether this makes sense. The question is how far the Netanyahu cabinet is willing to go before the US election, during the power transition in the US, and thereafter.
You mentioned October 7th. Do you think that the Israeli government knew about that beforehand and they just permitted to happen because of what was in their mind, that they can continue with that concept of Nakba that they've started in 1948? What was the end game in your opinion?
You can argue many theories. There are already what people call the conspiracy theories, and no, this was a plan of the Israelis, particularly the Netanyahu cabinet, in cooperation with the far right. And certainly it would fit with certain kind of apocalyptic tones of this government. And in the book, I argue that the ties of Prime Minister Netanyahu go way back with this kind of thinking. And he's not alone. There was a time, a period of time in the early spring when the Biden administration clearly was signaling that perhaps it would be easier to deal with somebody else representing the center-right or the conservatives, such as Benny Gantz. He also has his other foot very close to these far-right people. Same goes for Naftali Bennett and so on and so forth. So you can argue for these conspiracy theories. I'm not going to go there. You can also make an argument that there's a lot of unprofessional conduct here, that people didn't take seriously certain signals and so on and so forth. That argument, I think you can make, but it doesn't follow. If that was all there was, then we should have seen a police action against Hamas, targeted and highly focused attacks only against the assassins, efforts to really release the hostages when the negotiations began months and months ago. This did not happen. So where does it leave one? Let me take a step back 50 years and then come to the present. I'll go back only very briefly. One argument that used to stun me in the early 70s and made me a supporter of the peace movement was that with the fellow students at the time, I would say that why on earth wouldn't Israel not talk with Fatah? Why on earth wouldn't Israel not talk with Yasser Arafat? And the argument was always, oh, you cannot do that. He has dirty hands. He has blood in his hands. He's a terrorist. And then I would, of course, make the argument, knowing that it would hurt people even more, you know, that one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter. And what if you were a Palestinian? Would you not fight for your rights? Would you not start armed struggle if you felt that nothing else is really working here? And as terrible as it is, would you not start assassinations, my God? And those arguments were quickly buried, then the idea that you cannot talk with a terrorist. And then they asked what I think about it. And I said, well, you can do that. But then next you will have to talk with PFLP, whose line at the time was a bit more radical. And then if you refuse to talk with Arafat and PFLP, you will have to talk with PDFLP. There will be a still more radical side. And if you refuse to talk with them, perhaps you would have to talk with Abu Nidal, or who was the bad guy par excellence in the 1980s. And that's how I think we ended with Hamas, the Israeli refusal to talk. Now, when Hamas comes along, the argument was again, oh, we can't talk peace with them. They engage in suicide attacks. They did not in the very beginning to do that. They tried other means. And I haven't forgotten the fact that Hamas leaders, 1996, 1997, signaled willingness to talk peace. They signaled it, and they were pragmatic in that regard. Of course, they would negotiate for more. Why would they renounce their objective of destroying Israel until you talk in negotiations? Several ex-leaders of Mossad have made the same argument. Why would we ask Hamas to go so far when we didn't ask that even from Fatah? We didn't ask them to recognize us immediately. We wanted to talk. And let's not also forget the fact that when the peace process began, it did not begin with President Clinton there, Arafat here, Rabin and Peres here. No, it started in Oslo. It almost happened behind the back of the United States to a point, between the Israelis and Palestinians. Even with all the limitations of the two-state solution, there was that effort, at least in that direction. So what I'm trying to say here, that perhaps there has been this unwillingness to talk peace for a very long time. And in my book, in the last chapter, I argue that this may go back to 1948, 47. That was the first time when UN had just been created. A few months thereafter, they had their first intermediator, a Swedish count, Folke Bernadotte. And he suggested a lot of things, but he was also very concerned about the Palestinians. And his argument was that in war, all kinds of things may happen amid hostilities, but we should ensure that Palestinians who left their homes can come back and then build an enduring peace on that. A lot of Israelis at the time didn't like it, particularly those who represented the Stern group. They had him assassinated. One of the persons who ordered the hit, if you will, the assassination, was Yitzhak Shamir, who became the PM of Israel after Begin, and who was sort of a mentor and rival of Netanyahu prior to him. And Ben-Gurion's, the first PM of Israel, his bodyguard in the end of his life was Yehoshua Cohen, who was the assassin of Folke Bernadotte. So from very early days, there has been unwillingness of some Israelis, certainly not all of Israelis. I think that most Israelis, given a chance, would want to have peace. But they're led by the government who doesn't want it. And the government doesn't want it because U.S. and international community is not pressing it. And that's why I have this situation. So where does it leave us with October the 7th? I started writing an essay 2 or 3 days before October the 7th, arguing that we are in for an explosion in the Middle East. It's not because I'm a prophet. It's not because I saw this coming. But it was the 50-year anniversary of Yom Kippur War. And if I was Palestinian, if I was Hamas, I wouldn't let that day go by without some sort of a strong response. So I thought something might happen there. Soon thereafter, CNBC contacted Jan Bremmer from the Eurasia Group. And Bremmer said what a lot of people said at the time, that this is Israel's 9/11. And a few hours after October the 7th, we heard it from every tube, to the degree that I couldn't help but wonder, did somebody decide that we should talk about 9/11 here or not? There are different interpretations after all. Or maybe I'm just wrong, because I felt that there are a lot of characteristics to this offensive, but it certainly did not come out of the blue. It was a logical result of 50 years of failed military policies. It wasn't just a time bomb, it was about to explode. And now it has been exploding for a year. So what is the argument behind this? It is that right after this attack, October the 7th, it became very quickly known, and then the information increased within a week or two, that Israeli border soldiers had been signs of an impending attack for months, perhaps almost a year. Even CNN had a quite good piece about this a couple of weeks after the fact. And they had warned about this again and again and again, particularly in the weeks prior to the attack. They had seen even people preparing to use paragliders. They had seen people trying to use tunnels. They had seen people coming very close to the border walls. They had seen people rushing, driving bikes. I mean, what do you need? You don't have to be Marxist. You have to be Groucho Marxist in this case. If it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, perhaps it is a duck. So why was this information not taken seriously? There are administrative reasons, personal decisions that were made a few months before, a year or two before, procedures and so forth. Maybe those explain it. I also think that the border police were two things. They were minor officials and they were female. And Israelis, like many others, tend to think that, well, girls say this. Perhaps the girls that are in the border, they inflate things. But the net effect was the following. Most of the women who were in the border were killed. Only few survived, and those are the ones who were quickly interviewed by the Israeli TV. You know what surprised me the most? When these interviews were on, why on earth were they on immediately on the international networks? Why it has taken for months and months? I noticed that Spiegel had recently a story about this. It's great, but you know, a few months have gone by, a few moons have gone by as well. So there was something in the, about the international media that played down this aspect. All the focus was on the Israeli tragedy. And I have absolutely nothing against it. I think it's right. And I think that the victims and their families should have a say. I think they should have more of a say. But the moment those attacks targeted Palestinians, so should they have been interviewed. And not just those who were American Palestinian or American Jewish. Their fate was terrible and tragic and it should be talked about. But they were people from other countries. Aren't they human beings as well? International media totally failed in this. And as a result, I think people are only now beginning to understand what this means. And it's not just these so-called spotters, Israeli soldiers, who were warning again and again about this, but there was also the issue of so-called Gaza envelope. These are the Israeli communities surrounding Gaza. They were created already in the 1950s as military settlements. Then civilians took over, and they're still sort of paramilitary, several of them. But there's one curious thing about them. And the Israeli think tanks have noticed this and talked about it already 10 years. Even though we're strategic settlements that they were, the government didn't invest adequately and actually were reducing their investments in those, even as the anger in Gaza was increasing. So you have to ask, what kind of policy is this? And by the way, this happened long time before the far right ministers stepped into the government. This happened under Netanyahu governments way before. So I feel that this situation where the foxes entered the hen house is a result of all kinds of open questions. And I think that there will be an inquiry about this. And I do think that in this inquiry, there will be so much international attention that Israelis may actually get it right. But it will come too late. And then you start asking yourself, is the idea now to create facts on the ground that are irreversible by the time we understand the reasons for this situation? And in the book, I argue that yes, that's the case. That's why we are there. Why we are now where we are.
With these assassinations in Hamas leaders, military and political leaders, and the assassination of the head of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, is Israel benefiting from these assassinations in your opinion?
Is Israel benefiting from this?
Yeah, from these assassinations that are happening. Because right now in Israel, people are so happy. If you remember, before these assassinations, Israel, Netanyahu's position was not that good. People were against him, protesting. Right now, it seems that these assassinations are boosting his position in Israel. Is Israel benefiting from this assassination? It is just about Netanyahu and his position that he's trying to do these things to benefit from that? How do you find it?
In the short term, absolutely he is in Israel. If the idea is that when you kill a head of the movement disappears, if that's the logic and people believe in that logic, you are benefiting. And I think that we see that in the ratings in Israel. And I think that this has created a sense of empowerment, even within the cabinet. And certainly Netanyahu himself feels it. Perhaps he feels less of it when the missiles that were sent to Lebanon landed very close to his own home in Caesarea. But there is, yes, this feeling. You're absolutely right. But again, this is a tactic. It's not a strategy. And this is a tactic that started with the 1950s reprisals or cross-border wars, as Benny Morris used to call them, or the reprisal policies. This continued until 1967 war. Thereafter, there was a moment of quiet transition until 1982. I think there were a lot of people who did not question within Israel, Israel's right to respond as long as it was a question of an existential war. In other words, you would start fighting for your survival. That at least was the argument. That all changed in 1982. Thereafter, the wars that Israel has had, as far as I'm concerned, are not country, a state against state. They are Israel against insurgents, or what they call insurgents, what people elsewhere might call freedom fighters. They are counter-insurgency force. Parallels would be Algeria, Vietnam, and so on and so forth. And they never end well, just like Iraq never ended well to the United States. You cannot kill an idea. You cannot kill anger that has a valid basis. You cannot eliminate a dream that exists. You can certainly undermine the military capability of a movement for a while. And the fact that this has happened very early on and to the degree it happened with Hezbollah is a credit to the tactical genius of Israeli military. But that so-called genius relies on US intelligence. And that should make us cautious here. Do we see something here that is beginning to be reminiscent of the proxy war in Ukraine? Is this a new blueprint? First Ukraine, then Israel-occupied territories, perhaps then Philippines, Taiwan, China. There are a lot of uneasy parallels, and there seem to be similar elements here. So in the long term, I think that you have to build peace. You have to build trust. No peace starts without trust. And trust is always a bit of a leap to the unknown. This happened in Oslo when Rabin was assassinated, and he was assassinated by somebody who was part of the far right, who was intrigued by Rabbi Meir Kahane, whom I also met in 1970s, a militant anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian, American Jewish rabbi, who was most of the time in prisons. Even meeting him was hard because he usually was going into the prison or coming out. But I've never seen anybody so full of hate. And I knew that he would die violently as he did. This hate then becomes almost a habit. And what should concern everybody here is that the cabinet that's behind these attacks has quite a lot of these hateful men and women. And they have a very different endgame in mind. And I can't help but wonder, is the idea that you will just try to kill the next head of Hezbollah, whoever that person might be, and honestly, you can do so as long as US allows it. Of course, officially, that is not the case. President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, have for months and months said that we are working 24 hours for a ceasefire. Vice President Harris has done the same. But you wonder what this means. This is certainly the stated objective, but at no point of time has the flow of arms stopped fully, broad scale, wholesale. It simply hasn't happened. You can make an argument it has escalated. Normally it has been $3.8 billion a year. Now we're talking about $18 billion. So somebody's benefiting from this. In the book, I only see one major beneficiary, and these are the arms contractors. They are certainly injecting the U.S. economy and those who work for them and their shareholders with the great profit margins. Ordinary Americans are not benefiting from this. I think a third of Americans or more hate it. This is not good for anybody. So this idea that eliminating the heads of the resistance, you are creating a lasting peace, is simply untenable. Why would Israel then believe in this? I wonder whether Netanyahu fully believes in this, but he has also his own vested interest. As long as he is in power, he has immunity. And as long as he has immunity, he will not be prosecuted for the crimes, alleged crimes that he has been involved with. And they are many. There are literally hundreds of people willing to testify for this, some of whom have testified. The other day, a documentary on this, the Bibi Files, came into public distribution, but no network again wanted to touch it. So it had to go to a very specific private sector distribution. So no, I don't think that this leads anywhere. But if you take the mindset of the extreme right, the messianic far right, they see things differently. They feel, I think, that this is our opportunity. God is with us. God gave this land. God will take care of us. Of course, it will mean dead and refugees. That's very bad. But this belongs to us, and ultimately we will live here. Perhaps people don't understand it immediately, but over time they will. Only a few days ago, the same settlers who've been pushing for the creation of new settlements in Gaza were back in those borders. Something that we first saw in January this year, a big movement. There was also the ministers, Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and others, these foxes in the hen house, as I like to call them. They are waiting for this moment, and they think that it might happen. And then their argument will be very simple. Very good, you want to have a two-state solution. But look at Gaza, nobody's left. There's nobody to talk with. I'm sorry, that's what war is all about. International community could have stopped. They didn't, because ultimately they are with us. So Palestinians just have to go somewhere. This is what the intelligence minister in Israel in October said in files that were leaked in October. But those objectives were not that different from ones seen in late 1930s, early 1940s, with some Jewish agency leaders. The idea was the same. Hopefully a voluntary transfer of Palestinians away from the occupied territories and then take over. You start wondering where this really leaves the region. The immense injustice to the Palestinians, West Bank, Gaza, the immense injustice to Lebanese, and so on and so forth. Also, if this would really happen, you will not have a thriving peace movement in Israel. The ultra-right wing has won. But if it happens, the economy will take a hit. The brain drain from Israel, most of it to US, is relatively speaking now highest than it ever has been. Israel's crown jewels are the high-tech sector. Now, it is not being led by the settlers. It's not being led by people who believe that God will guide our hand through tanks and fighter planes. It is led by people who are very different, who believe in universal values, at least most of them, who believe in peace, who believe in dialogue, and they hedge their bets. They may have a dual citizenship. They may go to US, they may try to go to Europe, but this is now real. This is a real threat. And even if not all of them would move, look at the demographics. The great fear of the Israelis, particularly Rabbi Meir Kahane, far right, and many others, used to be that, well, if this continues, my God, the Arabs in Israel, Israeli Arabs, have a higher birth rate than the Jews. So Israel could turn majority Arab Palestinian over time. This can't happen. So they would have these very extreme movements against Palestinians, against Arabs in Israel. But we see now something very new that has happened in the past decade, and that is the rise of the so-called Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox. Actually, their birth rate is now significantly higher than those of Israeli Arabs, not to mention the secular Jews. And the leaders of Mossad have been warning about this for quite a long time, especially those who are no longer in the office, including Tamir Bardot, that if this continues, a major proportion of Israel will be Haredim. They don't work in high tech. They are subsidized by the state. They are subsidized because their tax revenues have been until now. But look at the net effect of that. The middle class has an extraordinary burden. It's ailing, it's suffering, it's growing poor, at least in the fringes, and this will expand more. Look at the smart ones. They may be leaving the country. They don't want to live in this kind of reality. Now, if you don't have the tax revenues, you won't have the subsidies for the Haredim. They depend on those. They do not want to serve in the military. They want to pray to God. And sometimes you see these cynical interpretations by the secularist Jews in Israel that what does this mean? Half a century from now, and you will have a lot of synagogues in Israel, but Israel will look very different, and perhaps it will no longer be called Israel. Now, they're stretching the point, but I think that the argument is very valid if you take a secular point of view, a point of view of 10, 20, 30 years. So even if there would be a triumph, a victory in this war, it would not bring military security, it would not bring sustainable peace, it would change the very nature of Israel, it would no longer be secular, democratic, it would become more Jewish autocratic, which is something most Israelis don't want to deal with. So they are paradoxical trends, they are dialectical trends, but they should make everybody very uneasy, not just the Palestinians, not just the international community, not just Americans, not just Israeli American Jews, not even the Jews only who say not in my name, as I would like to say, but also those who remain in Israel. This is untenable, unsustainable in so many ways.
I think what's going on in the United States is so important. We know in the past that presidents of the United States were capable at least to say no to Israel. Right now, it's just disappearing. With the Biden administration, you see he lets Netanyahu does whatever he wants to do. And on the other hand, the public opinion in the United States has drastically changed during the years. Do you think, in your opinion, when would be that moment that the United States decides to make a better approach toward what's going on in Israel? Because as you mentioned, liberal Jews in Israel are isolated in some ways. And we don't hear from them. It's all about Netanyahu, it's all about Likud party, his administration, people who are even the much more radical than Netanyahu, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, these people are running the show in Israel. And the question in the United States is the United States going to benefit from this situation that they're helping this administration to be more powerful by providing them with intelligence, with military aid, and the way they're supporting Netanyahu in any way possible? How would that benefit the United States in the long term?
I just don't see it how it would, because it's also creating a massive stress indirectly on the U.S. economy. The whole raison d'etre of the American military and economic aid to Israel stands on a very fragile point, because the U.S. debt per GDP is steadily rising. Now, Israel is just a small part of it, of course. United States is a very big economy, and they can do a lot of things, even wage wars in several fronts if need be. But as a result, their welfare is suffering, their social security is suffering. So you would look at those trends. Who are the people who feel this way? What kind of political actors are there that might be proponents of this way of looking at things? When I looked at Israel, one of the conclusions I had in the last chapter was the change can no longer come from within. There was a chance for that, I think, in the 70s. There were a lot of elements of that, partly still in the 80s. But thereafter, it's been a lot harder. There was a moment of time, brief, 3 to 4 years in the 90s with the so-called peace process, where you could have achieved a lot. But there was never that pressure that would have created more movement towards dialogue. Dialogue works between the Israelis and the Palestinians, Israelis and the Arab states. The U.S. objective is a grand bargain that would be mainly with the Gulf states, Egypt and a few others. But it has a lot of implications. It would also drive China out from the region. China's objectives are very different. What they are looking is not regime change, which has been American modus operandi since 1949, I believe, in the regime change in Syria. The Chinese objective is economic development. They believe because it worked in China, it could work elsewhere. And I think that you can make that case, because the level of economic development there are similarities, affinities in many countries in the Middle East, not all of them. Some are more advanced, but many there are. So the Chinese want to have that peace, stability, development, regional cooperation, objectives that Moshe Sharet in Israel tried to have in mid-50s. They could come back, but not without change from without. That requires the United States. And unfortunately, I don't see the political actors right now. You would like to think that it comes from one of the major parties. There were people in the Republican Party, James Baker comes to mind, who had very conservative principles, but who did try to push at least a two-state solution at one point of time. There was Obama, who really tried to push it to a point that was agonizing and frustrating. And yet, both presidents of those administrations ended up actually institutionalizing the weapons flow towards Israel, which is untenable in the long run. But this will happen as long as you have perhaps what some people call uniparty in the United States. In other words, two parties that may disagree on domestic policies, but want to have bipartisan foreign policies, and foreign interventionism is a big part of it. There are an increasing number of thinkers, people, academic policy authorities, even think tanks, that have far more nuanced point of view. But I don't think that they are politically influential yet. I'm hoping that the grassroots protest that is now happening on the Democratic side, to a point where it is seems to be changing some the platform from Biden to Harris, but not enough at all, that this would over time leave an impact. But in the short term, I doubt it will. Now, if you look at the Trump's time, or Trump administration, what they did, they basically ignored the Palestinians and the Palestinian case. It wasn't something worthy of their time. Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, who was one of his advisors, went on record early this year talking about how this ethnic expulsions, they're dirty business, you know, they're very dirty business. But, you know, you could perhaps build sort of a Gaza Riviera over time in this area and make a lot of money in the real estate. To say those things in the middle of ethnic cleansing, what I call genocidal atrocities, we could spend an hour talking about are they a genocide or not. I feel most of the conditions may be fulfilled here. But there certainly are atrocities. When one makes that kind of statements and has been very close to these administrations, you wonder, what is happening to human beings? Do we not see what's going on here? It reminds me, actually, the famous phrase that you saw in Warsaw Ghetto. Some people talked about it there. I think Elie Wiesel, whom I used to see in New York a couple of times, he also mentioned it. There was a sign on the wall, and the world is silent. That should frighten all of us. When there's an action, there's a reaction. And I think that's what's going to happen here. If the American intervention doesn't come fast enough, there will be another kind of intervention. And I'm not sure it's good for anybody. I personally believe that there's room in the region for both Americans, an American way of doing business, if you will, and the Chinese way of building peace through development and gradual prosperity. When people work with each other, invest in others' countries, there's less inclination to destroy their houses, their homes. That's a lot easier to military that doesn't look things in the long term, but mainly predicates everything on military tactic.
And with this conflict in the Middle East, we've seen that China is changing its approach toward what's going on in the Middle East. We had the new agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And later on, we had China bringing 14 factions in Israeli Palestinian factions together in order to make some sort of solution for what's going on in Gaza, in Palestine, between Israel and Palestine. And with the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, it seems that the Israeli government was successful in sabotaging what has been done by China. How do you, in your opinion, how do they feel in China right now about what's going on in the Middle East? Do they really think that it's possible to negotiate with Israelis? Because the way that Israelis are acting, it doesn't seem that they want any sort of negotiations. When you look at the assassination, it's all about negotiations. You kill somebody is a political leader of Hamas who has nothing to do with what's going on with the military part, because you at the same time you're negotiating with this guy in Qatar. Are they really interested in negotiations? If they're not interested in negotiating, who can bring some sort of sanity in their mind?
I think you make a very good case in the sense that there seems to be this unwillingness to deal with negotiations, and you try to downplay the role of the negotiations by getting rid of the negotiators. And as I argue in the book, this is not something new. If you look at it, as I mentioned, this example that if you don't talk with Arafat, you have to talk with PLO, you have to talk with PFLP, then with PDFLP, then with Hamas, something else will come along. Hezbollah, and thereafter still something else. And there will be more resentment, more anger, more bitterness, more pain. I don't see how that can be anything good. And I think that when we start seeing the realities of the so-called facts of the ground, in other words, we're not talking about just 42,000 people being killed, as terrible as that is. There are 10,000 or more who are still under the rubble. There are probably tens of thousands who are missing. There are people who are suffering from the ecocide. In other words, the ecological equilibrium of the area has been destabilized for years, possibly decades to come, at least 4 years. Just taking the rubble out would take maybe 10, 15, 20 years. The UN came out today with a study saying that perhaps development in the region in Gaza has been taken back by seven decades. So yes, there seems to be this case that there's unwillingness to deal with the negotiators. But look what it means. Despite the gap between the Israeli negotiators and Ismail Haniyeh, Haniyeh was on the political side of Hamas. He was a negotiator. He was considered to be pragmatic, very much in vain of his predecessor. It's an ominous trend, because when you get rid of negotiators in particular who are willing to negotiate for peace, there may come a point where people are less likely to do so. They lose all faith in negotiations. For a long time, Palestinians were blamed for not being willing to talk about peace. So then around 2018-19, we had the protest for peace in Gaza. People took their guideline from Gandhi and nonviolent movement and said that perhaps this will work when nothing else works. It didn't. Many people were shot, many people were maimed again without any talks resulting. So this unwillingness to negotiate remains there. I think that it could change overnight, not from within, but from without. If there's international pressure, particularly those who partner with Israel, it would happen when they press hard enough, because Israel cannot do what it does alone. Its weapons come from US, Germany, a very small part from Italy and a few other countries. But a lot of other things come from these countries as well. It depends on imports. It would like to have commodities from Turkey. Now it's a bit harder, and so on and so forth. No country is an island. Now, if you look at the Chinese point of view, I think that there's a great disappointment. When I've talked with people on the Chinese side, I think that there was this proud approach, this proud stance that China had been playing the role of a peacemaker, in the sense that first, there was this overall effort to de-escalate in the region, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere. Then there was this effort through the BRI, the Bridge and Road Initiative, to invest more in the area, to bring globalization to countries that missed it because of constant war and conflict in the region. Then there was this special rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which caught many by surprise. the fact that China was able to match objectives on both sides and bring years of apprehension, resentment, and hostility back to the negotiating table, working together for a better objective. And then lastly, as you mentioned, there was this objective of unifying the Palestinian front. There were, I think, 40 different members of the Palestinian groups in Beijing when the so-called Beijing Agreement was agreed upon a few months in the summertime. And that was a proud moment. Does it mean that this is all over now? Not necessarily so. Palestinian resistance or movement or parties have to be unified in order to make their voice heard. Unfortunately, they both then have the leaders that have been dear to them for such a long time, but they should have the right to choose those leaders. They can't be imposed from without. And I think that this, unfortunately, has been the objective by the Netanyahu governments. Labor governments were a bit different, some of them at least. But Netanyahu government, US administration talks about the reform of PLO. And the reality is that until recently, when you look at the ratings, public ratings by the Palestinian pollsters in the occupied territories, the simple reality is that Marwan Barghouti was the one person who was able to unify as a person these different movements. He's in prison. My dear friend, late Amos Oz, wrote a letter to him in the prison, and it was about his respect for a man who was imprisoned for his convictions. Netanyahu's government cabinet saw Oz as a traitor of the country at the time. Amos Oz saw things very differently. You need unifying leaders. Barghouti is one of those who could unify people who have been behind Palestinian Authority and Hamas. There's been a lot of talk about Mahmoud Abbas, but the reality is that his ratings are 5 to 10% at most. And unfortunately, not entirely because of the fault of the Palestinian Authority, partly because of the odd position that Israel and the US have left it, their support is minimal. Haniyeh had a very great support as well, not as much as Barghouti, but quite a lot. So these were the people that the Palestinians see as their representatives. They are not the people that US and Israel would like to see represent Palestinians. I'm not quite sure what they would be. Perhaps some people who originally came from Palestine are rich businessmen in the US, a bit like in the Iraq fashion, or who knows. But this is not, there's no respect in this for the popular will. And there has to be that if we really are to be talking seriously about the peace. But I don't think that the Chinese objectives have gone anywhere. I think that there may be also determination that the situation can get a lot worse unless it's controlled now. If we have 42,000 people officially having been killed on the Palestinian side, and the reality, after we find out what really has happened, may be closer to 180,000, at least according to the public health models by journals like Lancet and a few others, respected Western journals. When the realities of these massacres come to be known, then there will be more willingness. But then it may be too late. Is this really the objective that's being played out here by the cabinet in Israel? I can't believe and don't want to believe that Biden administration would want it, or if it would be a Trump or Harris administration would want it, would want to deal with anything like this. But the fact that there hasn't been a strong reaction, unfortunately, indicates that at least there is this perception of resignation or ignorance, letting things just happen. But there are no outsiders, there are no onlookers in genocidal atrocities.
Just to wrap up this session, in your opinion, who's capable of bringing some sort of peace to the Middle East? The international community, all the countries, superpowers, Russia, China, and regional powers, maybe Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, all together. In my understanding, I don't see anything happening without the United States. The United States is the key here. is the only, if you look at the attitude of the Netanyahu administration, whenever he's talking about China, Russia, he says that we don't need anybody. We have the United States supporting us. And here is the question. The main question is this possible to bring any sort of peace in the Middle East without the United States?
I tend to agree with the assumption behind your question. You know, there was a seminar in Shanghai, I think 2017, and I met General Eikenberry there. He was in charge of Afghanistan at the time. And he had written a very, I think, perceptive essay some months or a year before. And in that article, he said that we cannot have a foreign policy, us meaning the US, that's too much based on militarization, on military diplomacy. But he also pointed out, referring to the former leader of the head of the CIA, Gates, that there probably are more band leaders in military bands than US diplomats, literally. In other words, the human resources of Pentagon are far outweigh those of the State Department. And he knows, should know, he was in both. He asked that question and at the time when we were having a dinner. And I told him that I think that the US is in a critical position. And we can argue why it is there and how did we come up with the status quo. I think it is able to create that peace if it's willing to do so. And I think that one step towards that might be the adequate implementation of UN resolutions going way back, one by one. And that this would happen in a way that the settlements would take it back, there would be withdrawal, and there would be a sincere effort to find a resolution to the so-called refugee crisis that would involve all parties concerned, and that Israel would have its security guarantees and Palestinians would finally have the sovereign state that they were promised, 1947-48. When I said that, he smiled and was quiet, and so was I, because we both knew that it was a non-realistic proposition. There are no political actors who would push this, but I think that that's really needed.
Let me put up your book again. Here is the book that Dan wrote this year, and I don't know this year, was published this year, and The Fall of Israel. And the link to this book is in the description of this video. Thank you so much, Dan, for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk with you. And we're going to continue these talks. I think the situation in the Middle East is much more complicated. We need a lot of talks to understand what's going on in the Middle East. But at the end, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.